Madeline Bruiser tells us in The Art of Practicing that when one of her students was 6 years old, he attended a piano recital by Artur Rubinstein. The concert was sold out, and his seat was among many on stage, just a few feet from the great pianist. The young lad sat transfixed throughout the performance. 50 years later, he still remembers Rubinstein's face against the blackened auditorium, the angle of the lights falling on the stage, and the thunderous chords that opened the program. From the first sounds he heard, he knew that for the rest of his life, he would be bound in a powerful relationship with the piano. In a similar way, young Chris Colletti will never forget when the legendary Canadian brass came to his home turf on Staten Island. Because the players fanned out into the audience, there he was, side by side with the awe-inspiring trumpeter Ronald Rahm, as he played music by Giovanni Gabrielli. It hit Chris then and there. So that's what all this practicing and preparing is all about. The power, the precision, the beauty of Ronald Rahm's sound weaving together with his colleagues. For Chris Colletti, this was the pinnacle. How truly remarkable then that 8 years ago, this very music, this recording in fact, became Chris Colletti's entree into membership in the storied Canadian Brass Ensemble. Chris Colletti is a trumpeter and an arranger. He received his master's degree from the Juilliard School and his bachelor's degree from the Manhattan School of Music, and he completed that degree in just 3 years. Colletti has received multiple awards and scholarships. He's won a number of competitions, including the Music Academy of the West Chamber Concerto Competition and the Manhattan School of Music Concerto Competition. He is a recipient of the Tanglewood Music Center Charles E. Culpepper Foundation Fellowship and the Susan B. Kaplan Fellowship. He got his professional start as principal trumpet of the Huntsville Symphony in Alabama. He is comfortable in many styles. He's performed with a wide range of musicians, including Yefim Bronfman, Pierre Boulez, Michael Tilson Thomas, Quincy Jones, and Carlos Santana, to name a few. Chris Colletti has perfect pitch. He is a proficient whistler, and he has the unique ability to sing an operatic high C. The Brass Quintet, the Canadian Brass, which has performed in most major concert halls in the world, has been seen by hundreds of millions of people on television, sold more than 2 million albums, and contributed nearly 600 new works and arrangements, will be in concert at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, just outside Wilkes-Barre, on Tuesday, April 18th at 7:30 p.m. in Le Mans Theater in Walsh Hall. Members of the Canadian Brass have just embarked on a European tour, but they will be back in time to perform at Misericordia on April 18th. We had a chance to speak by phone with Chris Colletti about the Canadian Brass while he waited for a cab in New York to take him on errands, socks and such, before leaving for Germany.
Chuck Donbach started the group back in 1970. If you can imagine the career that 47 years old for a brass quintet, it's hard to believe.
I would think it would be like an organism. It's not an institution in an ivory tower.
Yeah, your choice of words are perfect. I mean, us youngins sort of grew up listening to Canadian Brass and idolizing the sound, and basically everything about the group was what we looked up to. And so on one hand, joining was a really big challenge because it was had such high standards. But on the other hand, because the group already had a sound that we were accustomed to hearing, it was a smooth transition. So, and of course, you can imagine what an honor it is to be a kid listening and idolizing to somebody and then suddenly becoming a member of that group. Is just amazing, and it doesn't get old. It's my eighth year, and I'm still just humbled by the whole thing.
Will you tell a wonderful story, and it's an object lesson for performers everywhere of all kinds, about being ready for the call. You can't make the call come, but when you get the call, you need to be ready.
That is so true. And, you know, it's often romanticized as this one moment where we get our big break. And there is some truth to that. But the reality is the perception that our colleagues have of us that we're often not even aware of is really what makes all the difference. My story of joining the group was I was a student at Juilliard, and a former member of Canadian Brass was also a student somehow at school. So when they were looking for somebody, he sort of asked if I'd like to hang out and play duets and make music together. And this is something musicians and trumpet players in particular do all the time, so I didn't really think much of it, and I was excited about playing with somebody who I thought was such a great player and such a creative person. And we had a blast, and we really hit it off, and we made great music together, and we did it again and then again. And then at the end of that third session, he told me that there was a recording session Canadian Brass was doing in Toronto of Italian Renaissance music, and they needed some extra players if I was interested. And of course I was. And what I came to learn later was that that was sort of the first step of my audition for the rest of the guys, and that they had sent him to find his teammate. And I was fortunate that he considered me. And when he left the group a few years later, I auditioned our current other trumpet player the same way, Caleb Hudson. And the thing that I think is really fascinating about that whole process is that he felt like he was auditioning for me perhaps when we were playing duets, and maybe his trial concerts in his mind were really important events where the break happened. But the reality is that he really won the audition before he even knew he was being considered, because his reputation was so good that as somebody that is always on time, somebody that always plays well, somebody that's a pleasure to work with, somebody that has leadership qualities but also knows when to take a step back. And the part that really fascinates me the most is how to give off the right vibes and be prepared so that you win the audition before you even know that there was one.
And you said just leading into that, you were stepping into something that already had a sound. Can you talk about that sound that you thought the ensemble had, and then once you got in it, your presence may have made a difference?
Well, first of all, by this point, we have 137 recordings, and I'm on 8 of them. So there was a huge library of music that I had already been listening to. So there was that added to my sense of what the sound was. And then I heard them live when I was pretty young. I grew up in New York City, and I heard them in my hometown in Staten Island, New York, and was blown away with the virtuosity, because I knew to expect that because the CDs demonstrated it. But what I didn't know to expect was just how fun and entertaining the show was. At one point, they played, sort of bringing that whole story full circle, they played an Italian Renaissance piece by Giovanni Gabrielli. And the way he intended these antiphonal pieces to be performed was he'd have players surrounding a cathedral so that the audience was really immersed in sound. It was really the first time surround sound was experienced by people on this planet, in a way. And so they did that. And Ronnie Rum, one of the original trumpet players in the group, was standing right next to me. And the person sitting next to me was holding his music for that particular piece, which really left a huge impact on me. And it gives me such joy to do the same.
And what about the dialectic then? You're doing this work with an ensemble that you respect tremendously. Each one of you has a point of view and a skill set that is incredible. And you all come together and make music that's larger than the sum of the parts. And yet, do you do work on your own that allows you to explore things that Canadian Brass may not have in its purview, even though the boundaries are very wide? Does that feed into what you bring to the group?
So, yeah, you said it. The boundaries are very wide. And I think that as a group that's been around for so long, the challenge is to be innovative and also be truthful and faithful to our current audiences and the sound that people have come to know and love and expect at our shows and CDs. So a lot of the things that we do, experiments that might be a little bit more off the wall before we take it to the group itself. So it's always with the understanding that we're trying something out, and the intention is that if it passes all the tests, we'll bring it to the group, which will just breathe it new life. And which really gives us a huge advantage as an ensemble, because there's this tremendous respect for the, in a way, the brand itself that we all have. And of course, we still have our founding member, Chuck Dalbach, tuba player. He's like Steve Jobs of music, I always say. He's like, we all respect him in so many ways, not only musically, but just for what he's been able to accomplish, the impossible, really. So our outside experiments, if you will, are really just extra fingers we have out into the world, testing things out before we introduce it to our faithful audiences.
Is strobe an example of that?
Strobe is absolutely an example of that. I've always been secretly really loving electronic dance music, and not all classical musicians like that. And so I did this arrangement. I told the guys. I didn't really sense that everyone was too excited right away, because everyone has different tastes, and mostly they just didn't think it would work. And we played through it, and everyone said, wow, this is really cool, and it's really hard. And it was a challenge to put together, and we decided that it was worth really digging in and going all the way with it. So we recorded it, and then we actually filmed the recording session. And we even had like a live studio audience for the recording. And then when we released it, I was so honored that we didn't even tell Deadmau5 that we had done the recording. He actually found it himself on YouTube and tweeted it to all his followers.
How about that for a compliment?
If only Bach had a Twitter account. If only Bach was on social media.
And you love Bach, don't you?
Really, Bach is, in a way, like our most home turf music. Everything he does is so incredible. On one hand, it's of divine quality. There's nothing like it. I don't know if any other person has ever written music of that quality. And on the other hand, it is so human and such a great, in a musical form, of the human experience. So it's this really incredible dichotomy. And I don't know if any other composer has really achieved that on that level. And it's music for organ and keyboards. And the keyboard music, which is, of course, masterpieces on their own, work particularly well for a small ensemble, because we bring life into each individual line that a keyboard player would just be playing with one finger. So we like to think that our arrangements of Bach are some of our strongest.
And arranging is something that you excel in.
I absolutely love it. My very first arrangement, if I could call it that, was when I was probably in fifth grade. And at the time, I had only heard other musicians that were of my age group, which of course wasn't that inspiring. And I heard a recording of Wynton Marsalis when he was playing classical trumpet still, and it absolutely blew me away. I didn't know that a trumpet was supposed to sound like that, and I don't think I ever sounded the same since. And on that recording was an arrangement that he had done of Pachelbel's Canon, and I think he overdubbed himself three times or something. And I wanted to play it, but that music isn't for sale. So I transcribed it slowly onto sheet music so I could play it myself. And then I got a multi-track recorder and recorded myself playing it. And then I had that written down on paper. And that was really my first transcription. And the fun thing is that my best friend got married a few years ago, and he requested that I play that arrangement at his wedding, and I did.
You have that sound, that Canadian brass sound. You know each of the players. And so when you do an arrangement, you have those players and their capacities in mind, and you can work in a creative way to bring the best out in all of you.
Exactly. And it's a huge advantage to be able to write for people that can, A, play everything, and, yes, we know each other's strengths, and we can play to them and write to those strengths. But on the other hand, we also want to make sure our music is accessible to other brass players. I can't take credit for this, but when Chuck started, I think there were two other brass quintets probably in the world. There was the Chicago Brass Quintet, consisting of the principal players of the Chicago Symphony, and the New York Brass Quintet, who were really, they were probably the first brass quintet ever. And I think American Brass Quintet was already around too. They're an older group than we are. So there are only a handful. And at this point, just looking at like sheet music sales, Chuck has a rough estimate that there might be over 1 million brass quintets, and that's just the ones buying music legally. So that's a huge growth in just a couple of decades for a genre that didn't exist 50 years ago, really. And so we make sure that our arrangements play to our strengths, but on the other hand, aren't purely the most impossible thing that only Bernard can play on horn and only Chuck can play on tuba, but something that after we perform it, that if an audience member is inspired, they can play it too.
But also teaching is important to all of you, to Canadian Brass, yes?
Absolutely. Actually, one of the things that helped form the structure of our show, which is, I think, one of the things that we're known for, was early on, Chuck had this idea that they should be playing, and they wanted to play in a brass quintet full time, and he had this idea that there were probably opportunities out there that
nobody realized were opportunities. And where he found that was actually outreach concerts through a symphony. And a lot of the symphony players felt like they'd rather be playing for mature audiences, and playing for kids was sort of a, like, it wasn't as fulfilling in some ways because they didn't have the attention spans of an adult, for example. So he formed the quintet, and they went out and would play these kids' concerts on behalf of the symphony. And that was about a time when there was some metric going around that a kid's average attention span was something like 33 seconds, which of course is way shorter than even the shortest piece that classical music that one could find. So their challenge was to present classical music, the best of the best that they could find that already existed, but present it in a way that a kid, a five-year-old kid, for example, with his peers would jump up and applaud the way they might react to a sports game or something. And it was something that they really tweaked and developed over hundreds of shows a year until they got what I guess one would call their big break, which was they were asked to go to China on a diplomatic mission to be the very first Westerners to go into China since the smashing of the Gang of Four at the end of the Cultural Revolution. And that really, even the New York Times weren't allowed, Americans weren't allowed at the time. This was before Nixon even went to China. And the New York Times was actually reporting through a Canadian reporter that was on tour with the group. This is in 1977. And it basically put them onto the world stage. And a year later, they became the first chamber music ensemble ever to play Isaac Stern Auditorium in Carnegie Hall. At the time, nobody thought that a chamber group or a soloist would be able to entertain an audience of 2,600 people. And they became the very first. So it's amazing opportunities came out of these children's shows.
Now, you're set to go to Germany, and we know that you get exposed to so much richness in terms of culture, and you're the kind of musician who absorbs everything around you, not just the other brass players, but you're going to be there taking in everything, won't you?
Well, that's the idea. That's what makes it so fun to go there. I mean, one thing that I think is very rewarding and maybe unique for us is that we have such an amazing following everywhere. So we go to Europe, and we've got audiences that Chuck and the original members were building and growing relationships with for decades. So we go there and we feel at home. We have audiences waiting for us and they recognize us and they're excited to see us. And of course, there's so much history in Europe. People have been living there for much longer and developing the cities much longer than here. So their building structures have so much history and are so fascinating architecturally. And the concert halls are generally smaller because they're older and they were designed for a different era. And they have beautiful acoustical properties, and they often look beautiful. They were often designed for kings and queens and princes and royalty, and it's just a really wonderful place to play and tour. But what I'm not sure you may not know, we are actually going to China at the end of this trip. We have one concert just outside of Hong Kong at the end of these 3 weeks, so that'll be a nice time to go back to China after all these years.
And so timely now. When you're doing an American tour and coming through northeastern Pennsylvania, you see how it feels leading up to that? How do you tell what you're going to include? Will we be surprised?
I will guarantee there'll be some surprises, and I can also promise there'll be Bach. We always include Bach on our programs. It wouldn't be a Canadian Brass show without it. And we're actually preparing a couple of pieces by Mozart, one of which we'll definitely perform there in Pennsylvania for U-Haul. And an amazing thing happens when we travel constantly and we're performing constantly. So a lot of the times we'll arrive in a city and all sorts, just the smells, the sights, just bring back all sorts of memories that you couldn't possibly muster without being in that place. And that click that happens sort of helps make the final adjustments on the program just before we go on stage. And we think that that approach, despite all the planning that goes into a tour, actually keeps it fresh, and it makes it so that we are confident that we're presenting something fun, fresh, unique for an audience in a way that we think that they're going to like the most. And you know, if anyone listening right now wants to stay in touch or get in touch before we arrive, we're very active on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We have a YouTube account, and our website is canadianbrass.com. And if you sign up on there, I think we'll send a free track that's not on any of our albums. And we really look forward to hearing from you, and we hope that you follow us on our trip to Europe and Asia.
trumpeter and arranger Chris Colletti of the Canadian Brass, speaking with us in anticipation of the Canadian Brass performance in our area at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, just outside Wilkes-Barre, on Tuesday, April 18th at 7:30 p.m. in Le Mans Theater in Walsh Hall. There is a premium seating option, and that will include a reception before the show, and there is a general admission option. Tickets can be obtained by calling the box office at Misericordia, 570-674-6719, 674-6719, or online at misericordia.edu, misericordia.edu. The celebrated Canadian Brass in concert Tuesday, April 18th at 7:30 p.m. in Walsh Hall in Le Mans Theater on the campus of Misericordia University in Dallas, just outside Wilkes-Barre. For more information, on the web, misericordia.edu, misericordia.edu.